defenders apart. When I look back on that period before that abbreviated debate with Peter, if you could even call it that, I see a trajectory that, thank God, the universe did not allow me to follow. But I can imagine a reality in which the rest of this book never happened and I spent my whole life, or at least the next few years of my life, as a bitter, angry pundit, arguing professionally with professional arguers. Not that I wasn't also having fun. Ripping the defenders' arguments to shreds, and then reading all the comments agreeing passionately with me and electronically patting me on my cyber shoulders was thrilling. It's so much harder to actually define yourself and work to imagine the best possible future than it is to tear down others' ideas. So I defined myself and my vision of Carl in opposition to the defenders. My path forward was the opposite of theirs, and theirs was the opposite of mine. It distilled itself down until all that was left was the argument. And maybe, lurking just beneath that, the hatred. It's so much easier for people to get excited about disliking something than agreeing to like it. The circle jerk of mockery and self-congratulation was so intense I didn't even notice I was at its center. It was so easy to get people to follow me, and in the end, that's what I wanted. It took no time at all for me to be just as bad as Peter Petrowicki. I shouldn't have been so surprised when things started escalating. I mean, I knew people hated me. It was a real thing. Being recognized by fans is very different from checking out at the corner store and not knowing if the clerk is a defender, thinking about what a dirty traitor you are. I thought that I could only either run away from that or fight it, so I fought it. Fear is an even better fuel than anger. Also, it is even more destructive. Their constant attacks meant I never had to doubt my message. It must be right, because the people who disagreed with me were so awful. The Carls were the perfect vector for disagreement because, through all of this, we still knew practically nothing about them. Governments were accused of hiding things because people just couldn't accept that those in power were exactly as lost as the rest of us. Human beings are terrible at accepting uncertainty, so when we're ignorant, we make assumptions based on how we imagine the world. And our guess is so obviously correct that other guesses seem, at best, willful ignorance. At worst, an attack. Here's a quick overview of what happens when groups of passionate believers start to define themselves in opposition to others. 1. A simple message seems obvious to a large population, and those people can't understand what the opposition could possibly be thinking. They never, or almost never, engage with someone who holds those different beliefs, and if they do, it's in the context of the discussion, not in the context of, like, also being a human. 2. The vast majority of those people nod appreciatively and then change the channel and watch NCIS and eat the tacos that they made. It's their own recipe. They've developed it over years, and they like it better than any taco you could get at even a super fancy restaurant. They go to bed at 10:30 and worry a bit about whether their son is adjusting well to college. 3. A very small percentage get really riled up. They're angry, but they're mostly worried or even scared and want to cause some kind of action. They call their representatives and do a little organizing. They're usually motivated not just by agreement in the message, but by a hatred of the people trying to fight the message. 4. A tiny percentage of that percentage just go way the fuck overboard. They get so frightened and angry that they need to make something happen. How? Well, that's simple, right? You eliminate the people who are actively trying to destroy the world. If we're all really unlucky, and if there are enough of them, those people find one another, and they confirm and exacerbate their own extremism. The bigger the defender movement got, the larger that fourth group became. Some of them were religious extremists who believed the Carls were a symbol of the coming apocalypse or rapture or whatever. Some of them were purely secular, deeply believing that America and possibly the world was going to be destroyed if nothing was done. No one was really clear on what that thing was, but no one was doing it. And eventually they came to believe that I was an active and informed participant in the government's, or the Carl's, plan to make humanity submit. This is the first time a truly international issue had hit our newly borderless world this hard. And no one knew how that might play out. The conversation was international, we all knew that. The comments on my videos were in Hindi and Japanese and Arabic and Spanish. We had a team of translators who would subtitle the videos within a day or two of them going live, and the Psalm was now operational in more than 20 different languages. I saw this as an unambiguously good thing. I felt very strongly that the Carls were a globally unifying force. For the first time ever, humanity was literally sharing a dream. It felt more like we were sharing a planet than ever before, and to me that felt like a gift given to us by the Carls. I still believe the Carls were very good for the world. But obviously, July 13th made that a lot more ambiguous. The coordinated attacks in Sao Paulo, Lagos, Jakarta, and St. Petersburg killed more than 800 people and injured thousands. That the responsible group had managed to plan an attack in four different continents boggled the mind. This wasn't radicals making plans in back alleys. It was a growing, worldwide, borderless movement. In the U.S., it was the Defenders, but every culture had their own name for it, and they found commonality and connection in pop-up forums and anonymous chat rooms. They had convinced themselves that the Carls would be easy to destroy and that world governments were lying about their invulnerability. They also convinced themselves that tourists visiting Carls were not worth saving or protecting or whatever. Whether they saw it as a pilgrimage to a false deity or an act of submission to alien domination, it didn't matter. Any positive connection to the Carls was a threat to the ideology they wanted to push forward. The Carls could not be seen as safe, even if they were the ones making the Carls dangerous. The Carls, of course, were completely unhurt. The attacks were synchronized at roughly 4 a.m. Eastern Time. That maximized crowds in Jakarta, Lagos, and St. Petersburg. It was still early morning in Sao Paulo, but they coordinated the time with the other attacks nonetheless. At that exact moment, 4 a.m., when those bombs went off across the world, I awoke from the dream where I had been staring blankly at a 767 and shot out of my bed in fear and terror. Was I somehow physically roused? Had I sensed a great disturbance in the force? Did Carl reach out to me through the dream to tell me of the attacks? No. I had heard a loud crack from the direction of the sliding glass door that led to my little balcony. My blinds were closed, of course, so I couldn't see what had caused the noise. My first thought was that someone had thrown a rock at it, but from 8 stories below, that would have to be some arm. Things had been getting heated with the Defenders. The messages were sometimes mean, sometimes threatening, and sometimes deeply fucking disturbing. I grabbed my phone as I got out of bed and slid it into my pajama bottoms. I flipped on the light, and as my heart rate slowly returned to normal, I went to look out the window. At the base of the drapes, which hung all the way to the floor, if I had looked, I would have seen some little specks of glass mixed in with the Pop-Tart crumbs and dust, but I didn't look. I just drew back the drapes to see what may have made the noise. Looking back on this behavior, it's depressingly dumb. Something has hit my window, and what's my plan of action? I've got it. I'll turn on the light and pull back the drapes in front of a glass door. Slowly. Even with all the threats, it was still somehow inconceivable to me that someone would actually try to kill me. Harass me? Sure. Threaten me? Yeah. Sue me? If they could find a reason. But murder? That shit's for the movies. People don't kill people. I mean, they do, obviously. I've seen a newspaper. It says something, maybe, about how my mind works, that I had received literal death threats, but never considered that someone would try to kill me. But now I was thinking about it, and two things happened simultaneously. One, something big, at the time I thought it must have been a person, slammed painfully into my shoulder, knocking me away from the door. Two, the glass in my double-paned sliding glass door erupted out, spraying into the room and leaving a 2-inch-wide hole. I hit the floor hard, and the thing that had shoved me was gone before I could regain my wits. Little shards of glass lay all around the room. Having by this point figured out at least half of what was going on, I crumpled myself against the wall of my bedroom, too scared to cry. Someone had just tried to shoot me. Not like, scare me, but actually put a bullet in my chest so that I could lie on the floor of my lonely apartment to die all by myself. And who the hell had shoved me? They had saved me, but they were also in my apartment. And then I was no longer too scared to cry, and I cried. My blinds were still open a crack, and I was afraid that at any moment bullets would come flying through my window like a true war zone, and if I was not backed against a brick wall, I would be torn apart. But after about 10 minutes of gasping for air between sobs, I convinced myself that I could sneak out of my bedroom and into the living room, where the windows faced a narrow alley, not the street. So I half crawled, half ran out of the room. Once in my living room, I had access to a bathroom, a carpet, and the kitchen. Everything a girl needs. I did a cursory search, which uncovered nothing out of the ordinary. Clothes, carry-out containers, dirty napkins, maybe a damp towel or two. No sign of an intruder. Should I call the cops? I thought. I mean, I definitely should call the cops. Someone was very probably trying to hurt me, and maybe also there was literally a stranger hiding in my apartment right now. But for some reason, I really, really, really didn't want to tell anyone. Maybe I was being silly. There is probably some reason for all of this that isn't attempted murder, my mind was telling me. So far, attempted murder has never happened to me, so it seems like there must be some other explanation. And if it was real, other things were real, too. Dealing with a police investigation and the reality that I could never sleep safely in this apartment again. And, oh God, my parents would have to know. And Maya. I knew she'd never say it, but inside there would be that part of her thinking, if only April had listened to me, this wouldn't have happened. And I couldn't live with that. I couldn't live with any of those scenarios. So instead of the police, I called Robin. April, he said after one ring. Now, he never sounded put out, though I'd never before called him at 4 a.m., but he seemed positively to have been expecting my call, which threw me. Were you expecting me to call? Not expecting, but it is not surprising, given the reports. Remember, I had been dealing with my own crisis. By this point, the Sao Paulo and St. Petersburg attacks were already being reported on American news. Someone must have called Robin from a less ridiculous time zone. What reports? Oh, my. Oh, you're what? This was not how I was expecting the phone call to go. You should tell me why you are calling. I think that would simplify this conversation. I think someone's maybe just tried to hurt me. There's something very strange going on. Have you called the police? His voice was at a pitch I had never heard before. That doesn't seem necessary, I half complained, half ordered. It does, though. Let's just not have them involved yet. Would you be all right with me sending up the doorman? Yes, I suppose that's fine. I will call you back momentarily. He hung up before I did. In that moment, I had a thought. Whoever, or whatever, had hit me had to still be in my apartment. It wasn't in my bedroom, and I wasn't going to check the second bedroom. That room had a window overlooking the street, and I didn't even know if the blinds were drawn. But it wasn't a huge place, and I hadn't actually looked very hard, so I looked under the couch and the chairs. Nothing. So I turned them all upside down. There was this weird, black, meshy fabric covering the bottom of one of the chairs. It had been carefully and exactly cut along one side. My phone rang. Robin. I muted it. I slid my hand into the tear and ripped the fabric off the chair. There, stretched out across the full width of my living room chair, wedged in place in the wooden frame, was Hollywood Carl's right hand. Chapter 14.
Bang, bang, bang. Miss May, are you all right?
The voice was muffled through the door. My heart, having stopped beating completely, exploded. I gasped and looked back toward the door, then immediately back at Carl's hand, which had not moved.
I'm fine, I yelled, not sounding fine.
May I please come in and have a look around?
I was doing everything in my power not to look away from the hand. It was unmistakable. 3 times the size of a man's hand, made of that mix of silver shine and matte black armor. It was beautiful. I wanted to touch it, but I was terrified.
False alarm! I'm an idiot!
I screamed into the underside of my very nice living room chair.
Still, it wouldn't hurt for me to have a look around.
Through the door, I heard no indication that he was going to give up.
I'm not wearing pants!
I was wearing pants. There was some quiet murmuring, and then I realized he was talking to Robin on his cell phone.
Could you please call Robin back because he is not letting me take no for an answer, and I do have a key.
Reluctantly, I looked away from the hand in my chair for a moment to call Robin. When I looked back, it was still there, splayed out, holding its place in the base of the chair. Did it even know I had found it? I interrupted Robin as soon as he started talking. Everything is fine. Call off the troops. Not everything is fine, and my primary need right now is to see that you are safe. There is a reason why you are not letting me fulfill that need, and I need to know what it is. I looked at the hand, thinking that if Carl wanted to hurt me, then my entire life was a lie, so it couldn't be possible. I am safe, Robin, I promise. Are you aware of the situations in Sao Paulo and St. Petersburg? News from Lagos and Jakarta hadn't reached the U.S. yet. I am not. There have been terrorist attacks on the Carls. Many people are dead. April, I'm afraid that you are a target as well. Fuck, 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 I thought. Fuck, I said. Oh, God. And then a lump rose in my throat, but I didn't make a sound. This was too big, and it sank in for real that someone had definitely, absolutely, tried to kill me just now. Rather than blowing up New York Carl, they had thought maybe a scalpel would be better than a cleaver. I felt like I was going to throw up. What if I had died? I reached under my shirt to feel my own skin, warm and soft and fragile as air. I looked down at the hand again and noticed for the first time something gray and dull in among the silver and black. Wedged between two of the armor plates was a jagged piece of something. I reached in and pulled it out. A shard of metal. A fragment of a bullet. I held it in my hand, cold and innocuous as a penny. Are you okay, April? Not particularly, no. I tried to keep my tears out of my voice, but I failed. It's a lot, I know. I can hardly believe it's true. Please, I'm on my way to you now. Please let Steve in to check on you. I will be there soon. No, Robin, I'm safe. I promise. I couldn't tell him about the hand. I thought there was someone in my apartment, but I just saw it. It's a giant rat, and now there's a terrorist attack, and I feel so silly. Please, I want to go back to bed. Let's talk in the morning, okay? Okay. I'll let Steve know. He sounded drastically unsatisfied, but he still hung up. Carl's hand had not moved, though it seemed unmistakably alive. You know how when you're trying to get some stuff out of your car and there's like one too many things to bring them all in one trip? You keep trying to figure out how to hold something slightly differently so you can save yourself the extra time. So you put some stuff down and consolidate some bags and you think you've got everything, but then you look down and realize that the cat food or the soda from lunch or the picture frames are still sitting there and you've got no way to pick them up. There's a moment when one extra thing just breaks the whole process. If only you didn't have that thing, this would be a situation you could easily manage. Well, that's the way my mind felt in that moment. Except instead of one too many world-shattering, life-altering unpleasantnesses, there were like five too many to hang on to. Every time I spent time concentrating on one, some part of my brain would notice another lying in the trunk of my brain car and flip out with frustration and impotence. I know a lot of people were feeling that way that day, but I'd like to think I had a couple of extra worries, and that might explain my behavior over the next 24 hours. So like any good, barely adult human, I flipped out and threw all of my angst groceries back into the brain car and gave up on trying to figure anything out. Instead, I concentrated on what I knew. Carl's hand hadn't been seen in months, and there it was, right in front of me. I was April May, documenter of Carl activities, so it was time to document. I flipped my phone around and turned on the camera. The hand spun around suddenly, got its fingers under itself, and shot out at me before I had the video started. I staggered backward with a yelp that I'm glad no one else heard. My heartbeat thudded in my ears. Okay, okay, I said as I put my phone back in my pocket. It peeked out from behind the couch and then came out as slowly and carefully as a stray cat. This was all excellent distraction from the fact that a real human person who existed in the world had tried to kill me. It was much more important that Carl, or at least some part of him, had saved me. And so, one, Carl was alive. Two, Carl knew who I was. Three, Carl had at least two desires. One, that I not die. Two, that I not take any pictures of his disembodied hand. With my brain at 25% power, all I really wanted was to thank Carl or Carl's hand. I reached out to it, and it approached me. It walked on all fives, each finger thudding on the thin carpet covering the wooden floor. Thanks for... I felt a little silly talking to it, but kept going anyway. Everything, I guess. But mostly just now for literally taking a bullet for me, I guess. The hand bowed. I mean, maybe. It flattened itself against the floor a bit and then stood back up. Can you understand me? Nothing happened. One tap for yes, two taps for no. Can you understand me? Two taps. What? I literally screamed. The hand stood there in front of me, looking rather smug. Are you messing with me? Did you just make a fucking joke? Nothing. Okay, so you can see me and apparently hear me and possibly understand me and also apparently mock me. Correct? Nothing. Can I touch you? Nothing. I know only yes means yes, but it was a robot hand in my apartment, and it's not like I had invited it over. I reached out to it, to feel it, and it let me. I touched it. It felt different now. Not like touching Carl, that weird way it left all the heat in my hand. It just felt hard, and very, very slightly warm. Carl also had always been completely immobile, but the hand was so clearly alive. Even when it wasn't moving, it had movement in it. It had life to it. Compared to the immobile statue that was Carl, it felt so much more complex and carefully crafted. Every joint as supple and nimble as my own hands. We don't, generally, look down at a human hand sliding over a keyboard or stroking a pet or punching buttons on a remote control and think, what a marvel. But it truly is. Humans have yet to create something so delicate and intricate as our own hands. But Carl's hand was every bit as careful and nimble as my own, and a great deal stronger, it would seem. I pulled my phone from my pocket, and Carl skittered away again. I'm just calling Andy, I said. You know Andy, right? So I punched him, number two on my speed dial after Robin these days. The phone rang once before noise exploded in my ears. I threw my phone across the room, screaming. Once it wasn't right up against my ear, I could hear it clearly. Ship on my way to Mars, on a collision course. I am a satellite. I'm out of control. I am a sex machine ready to reload, like an atom bomb, about to explode. Queen, don't stop me now. You're blocking me, I accused the hand. Panting from my freakout. Nothing. Look, I don't know what you want, and I'm not going to know unless you tell me. Nothing. I grabbed my computer off the coffee table and sat on the floor with it a foot away from where the hand had taken residence. The Wi-Fi signal was strong, but every website timed out. Well, what am I supposed to do then? As you might have expected by this point, nothing. Can I tell anybody? Two taps. Was that an actual response? One tap. This is really happening. Nothing. Are you from outer space? Nothing. Have you heard about the Carls in St. Petersburg and Sao Paulo? Nothing. Can I tell anyone you're here? Two taps. Can I tell anyone you saved me? Two taps. Can I at least tell Robin? Two taps. Would you stop me if I tried to tell someone? Nothing. I must have asked the hand 1,000 questions, and the only information I got out of it was that I was not, under any circumstances, to share that it had visited me. No one could know. No one could see it. I felt, of course, tremendously obliged to keep this promise, because if the Carls did have some kind of massive plan, I sure didn't want to mess it up. Also because I had built a whole life around believing the Carls were good. Also because of the whole life debt thing. But that also meant not telling anyone that I had been shot at.
This line of inquiry, of course, led to no response. The hand did not appear to be concerned about my safety. Possibly it thought it could guarantee it. How was I supposed to tell anyone that I'd been shot at without breaking this promise? Also, what was I going to say to the superintendent about the blown-out doors in my bedroom? And how was I supposed to clean up the rest of the glass without getting shot at again? That is not a normal thought, but it was a thought I had. Maybe there were bigger concerns. As time somehow kept moving, the various sizes of various concerns were starting to seem less relevant. All my worries, from terrorist attacks, to almost dying, to whether I should clean the glass on my floor, somehow all seemed the same size. I realized I was crashing down from my high. My body had been in fight-or-flight mode for at least an hour, and exhaustion was kicking in hard. I reached out to the hand and wrapped my hand around its massive index finger. "Why did you save me?" I asked the hand. It didn't do anything. "Okay. I won't tell anyone." It looked to me as if maybe, just a tiny bit, it relaxed. Without thinking, I scooched toward the hand and curled myself around it, and it settled a bit into my embrace. I was asleep in seconds. I don't want to have real dreams, so I just wander the city all night. The whole world is waiting for the key, searching fruitlessly, even though I'm the only one who can get it. But I still haven't let Miranda or Maya share what we know. We're lying to the whole world. My fear and my mood have followed me into the dream. I walk into an arcade like from the 80s. There are tons of stand-up video games and pinball machines. The puzzle sequence in here must be delicious. I spot a quarter on one of the machines. That's probably where the sequence begins, but I don't play. I go to the girls' bathroom. It's dirty and there are local band posters all over the wall, but none of them make any sense. My brain can't turn the letters into words. This tends to be the case when you get off track. It's a sign that you aren't in an important part of the puzzle. It's like the Carls couldn't be bothered to create the detail of every little spot. I go into the dirty stall and sit on the toilet and cry until I wake up. Chapter 15. I woke to distant shouts. Reality crashed into me. Someone bombed Carls all over the world. Someone tried to kill me. They looked into the scope of their rifle, saw me, and pulled the trigger. And Carl's hand. It was here, and it saved me. And where was it? I shot up off the floor and searched every inch of my living room and kitchen. Then I stood outside of my bedroom door, but I couldn't make myself go in. I gave up. I never went into either of the bedrooms again. In my heart, I think I knew the hand had departed as sneakily as it had arrived. I could hear people shouting in the street below, but again, I couldn't go look out the window, so I turned on the news. The news media is almost always in a bizarre, frantic resting state. During these rests, it tries to make distant and vague threats seem up close and menacing in order to give you some reason to watch their advertisements. Here's a hint. It's not really news until they stop running ads. There were no ads this morning. The July 13th attacks were real news, and everyone knew it. The fact that America was spared, though you, unlike anyone back then, now know that there was a planned attack, it was simply thwarted. Well, I guess not simply thwarted. Created excellent opportunities for rampant, useless, baseless speculation. Occasionally they would show images of 23rd Street, which was packed with people whom the police were incapable of controlling. Most of the people in the crowd came to show that the world stood in solidarity with Nigeria, Russia, Indonesia, and Brazil. Others were protesting the continued threat Carl made. Analysts on television were saying terrifying things about a strategy terrorists sometimes used. Do something inflammatory and then, once the inevitable crowd formed, strike again with much greater impact. Since America hadn't been part of the attack, and Americans are incapable of considering that evil people would coordinate a massive attack and leave us out of it, everyone assumed something else was coming. As I watched the news, a thought leaked into my mind. The world was tearing itself apart. People were dying.
The noise in the street threatened to become a riot if a bunch of defenders showed up. It was easy for me to blame all this on Peter and people like him. But ultimately, wasn't the source of it all Carl? Wouldn't those people still be alive if Carl hadn't shown up? Wasn't I as biased and irrational as the defenders? Clinging to my unquestionable belief that Carl was here to bind us together, not to divide or destroy us. Seeing only the evidence that confirmed my point of view and not the evidence right here in front of my eyes that Carl was undeniably disruptive. I realized that there was no way for that not to be in my brain in my next TV interview, though certainly I wouldn't mention it. And that's when I realized that I wasn't supposed to be watching the news about Carl's, I was supposed to be on the news about Carl's. And then I panicked a bit. Why hadn't anyone called me? I grabbed my phone and saw a fairly simple explanation. It was off. I tried turning it on. Out of batteries. Oh, God. Robin was probably having a fit. Everyone was probably having a fit. Why wasn't anyone at my house? And worse, both my chargers and my other phone were in my freaking bedroom. Okay, computer then. At the very least, I had to tell everyone I was okay. I popped open my laptop. It seemed that my connection to the outside world had been restored. As expected, I had about 500 new emails. TV producers, Robin, Andy, Miranda, Maya, parents, brother, everyone. Notifications from the SOM were out of hand. Here's what was not expected. I had replied to many of the emails. That was confusing enough that I didn't understand it at first. I read the email Miranda had sent, and then I read my reply, and I tried to figure out who it was from. It sounded like me, though it wasn't complicated, basically just letting her know I was okay and would need some time before I did anything publicly. My first thought was that Robin had, in a panic, impersonated me. Then I saw a whole conversation I'd had with him about why I wasn't answering texts and that I needed time to process and would be in touch soon. I'd told him to start a list of people interested in talking to me and it would be late morning before I could take any interviews. Andy's insistence that we make a video was responded to similarly. A message to my parents and brother told them not to worry and that I was safe and being looked after and the whole thing was just so terrible and I would call soon and thank you for worrying about me, but again, I was fine. There was no response to Maya's email. It is possible, I do not think this is what happened, but it is possible, that I woke up several times and answered those emails, and then fell asleep between sessions. They were spread out over several hours, and was experiencing some kind of post-traumatic amnesia. I certainly would not have questioned the email's validity if I had been any of the recipients, and if I had been awake, I probably would have sent extremely similar emails. But I had not been awake. I read all of my sent and received messages and found no hint as to their origin. I did my best to imagine Carl's hand curled over my phone or computer typing out emails, but I figured I couldn't dust for fingerprints or anything. In the end, and until just now, actually, I just pretended I'd sent the messages. I was suddenly living a number of rather large lies, and this one seemed pretty inconsequential. I was numb to oddity. I emailed Andy telling him I wanted to do a shoot down the street in the next few hours, and told Robin to start scheduling for Skype-ins, starting at noon and ending at 4, and that things would be weird, but he had to just simply not ask any questions. Also, could he bring me something TV-worthy from Topshop and an iPhone charger? Having an assistant is awesome for when you are terrified to go into your own bedroom because of last night's attempted murder. Before showering, I finally tweeted something. At April maybe not. Sick with sadness. I have misplaced my hope. Let's be together today and remember our humanity, not our brutality. And then immediately after, at April maybe not. Just a few people did this. In a world of 8 billion, I am trying so hard to remember how few of us are truly evil. I don't think I actually felt any of those ways, but it seemed on brand. Those seemed like the kind of things April May would tweet. In reality, I felt numb, and I wanted to work. I wanted to write and talk and figure out how the defenders were responding and start up the counter-arguments immediately. Even if I was finally questioning my own faith that the Carls were only here to help us, it was easier to act than doubt.
The police and government at that point were still searching for information on several disconnected bombers. We had no real information, and so the vacuum was being filled by lies, guesses, and assumptions. At least I refused to give in to that impulse. Humans are terrible at believing reality. The things I tweeted about July 13th were absolutely true. These attacks were the work of such a minuscule number of people, a number so small as to be inconsequential. And the number of people hurt and killed on a global scale wasn't a huge deal either. More people died in car accidents on July 13th than in those bombings. But these are things you can't really say in the face of tragedy. We are irrational beings, easy to manipulate if you're willing to do whatever it takes. That's exactly how terrorists convince themselves that murder is worthwhile. And the wound it left was larger than those lives lost. It was a wound we would all have to live with forever. The purity of my feelings for Carl was gone, and I would never get it back. Chapter 16. Here's a weird thing. You remember July 13th, and I sure hope you remember September 11th, even if you weren't alive. But we've pretty much all forgotten June 28th. June 28th, 1914, to be exact, probably the weirdest day in recorded history. Here's what happened. The guy who's next in line to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was this huge politically important country, second largest in Europe by size, third by population, was visiting Sarajevo, which is now in Bosnia, but was then part of that massive empire. A lot of folks living there didn't like the Austro-Hungarians for complicated reasons that we don't need to get into. A group of young guys, having decided they want to kill this prince, who has, in his wisdom and bravery, pre-published the route he's going to be taking through Sarajevo in a literal open-topped car, note to world leaders, stop doing this. These 20 men line up at various places along the published route with various devices and strategies for assassination. One of them jumps the gun a little bit and runs out of the crowd with a small bomb. He throws it at the prince, but the bomb doesn't detonate for several seconds, so it ends up exploding near a different car and injuring several people but not killing anyone. Everyone disperses. The heir to the throne gets swept to safety, and none of the other would-be assassins get to try their hand at assassination. That's a weird day already, right? Well, it gets much weirder. The parade, of course, is called off and the prince is safe. But then he decides, in his wisdom and bravery, that he wants to go visit the people injured in the bombing at the hospital. The driver takes what is likely to be the worst wrong turn in history, and then, realizing it, puts the car in reverse. It's 1914, and cars are very new and glitchy, so the car stalls in front of a deli where one of the foiled assassins, Gavrilo Princip, just happens to be standing. Princip steps forward, pulls out his gun, and fires two shots. One hits the prince, who by now I hope you figured out is Archduke Franz Ferdinand, in the neck. The other hits his wife Sophie in the belly, killing her quickly. An aide, trying to hold closed the hole in the neck of his prince, asks him if he's in pain. The Archduke says, "It is nothing." He repeats this, "It is nothing. It is nothing," over and over until he falls unconscious and then dies. It was not nothing. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand touched off a cascade of terrible decisions and reckless diplomacy that ended in the deaths of more than 16 million people. Keep that in mind if it seems like the following events are improbable. Sometimes weird things happen that change the course of history. And apparently, they happened to me. Andy looked like he'd slept a good 13 minutes. He was untidy and quiet, and I could definitely smell him as he adjusted my lapel mic. "You okay, dude?" He looked at me like he was just realizing I was there before moving his eyes back to his work. "Yeah, fine. I'm fine." "I don't think you're fine." He snapped out of it a bit then. "Fuck, April, of course I'm not fine. What the hell are we doing?" He didn't sound agitated. He sounded tired. "We're going to go out there and try to make this a little better for everyone. I need to believe something myself." "Do you have any idea what you're going to say?" "I have a couple ideas." I'm not sure I did, but I felt pretty sure that something good would come to me. Is there anything you think I should say? Aside from that the world is awful and how the hell did we come to this? He sank down into the sofa. I hadn't told Andy about the shot. I hadn't told him about Carl Jr., and I hadn't seen any sign that it was still in my apartment. If it hadn't left, it was in one of the rooms I wasn't going into. I looked down at Andy, understanding for the first time that his eyes weren't just puffy with lack of sleep. I realized I hadn't cried yet. That was messed up. I thought about just crying right then. It would have been easy. Just relaxing a mental muscle and I would have been gushing. But then I thought, for real. Nah, April, save it for the camera. Gross. Out loud, I said, all those people out there, they're defying the police and the terrorists to stand with Carl, to stand with us, to simply say the world is not awful. That's what we need to go down there and do. April, on the news, they're saying there might be more attacks. Look at all those people down there. No one's checking backpacks. I almost had a panic attack just getting into your building. I spend all my time on the news. It's their job to scare you. I watch it firsthand all day long. I will say this for myself. I wasn't giving Andy a pep talk because I needed him. I could have gotten someone else to hold the camera. Hell, I could have gone down there with a selfie stick and it would have been great footage. I wanted him to do it because we were in this together and I wanted him to feel that way. I felt as if I was telling him the truth. I was just giving him a dose of reality because I thought it would make him feel better to do something great on a terrible day. I was kinda right, I guess. I guess. Remember when I called you in the middle of the night to go look at a weird sculpture? I did that because I thought you wanted something, and I could help give it to you. But Andy, you are so much more than I thought you were then. And I'm so much less. I don't need you to help make me famous. I need you to help keep me sane. There's nothing more dangerous outside that door than a Halsey concert. He had his eyes closed, but I could see the concentration in his face. I don't know if he was concentrating on keeping his mind in the present, on facing his fear, on not crying, or on not saying things he wanted to say to me but knew he shouldn't. In any case, it was clear that he was working hard. Let's go down there and make the world a little better, okay? Andy was shooting on a DSLR about the size of a tea kettle with a big, heavy, wide-angle lens on it to help him get good shots even in close quarters. With the mic receiver and preamp assembly, it was about a 3-pound rig. 10 years ago, a setup to get similar quality video and audio would have weighed at least 30 pounds. Another nice thing about wide-angle lenses, they don't show shaking as much. That's good when you're getting jostled around by a crowd, or just shaking in terror. Jerry, the doorman, was worried as well. April, I have to advise you not to go out there right now. What fantastic advice. We'll be fine, Jerry. It's more of a party than a protest. I was nervous, but Andy was green and sweating. April, I'm responsible for your safety when you're in this building, but once you're out there, there's nothing I can do. His paternalism was cute up to a point. This is what I do, Jerry. You are awesome. We'll be back in 5 or 10 minutes, I promise. We pushed through the revolving doors, me ready to start talking, Andy with the camera already rolling. I turned around immediately and started walking backward into the crowd of people, speaking just above normal volume. You've probably seen this video, but it feels like part of the story, so I'm telling it. April May here, on 23rd outside Gramercy Theater, the residence of New York Carl, where the impromptu response to what will undoubtedly come to be known as the July 13th attacks is one of solidarity, hope, and friendship. Only a few stragglers of the Defenders movement have shown up to continue their outrageous protest of a clearly benign presence in our cities. People are starting to take notice. They almost all recognize me, and they're giving us a bit more room to move. I'm moving toward Carl. I want to see if I can get him in the shot, but you never really notice how wide streets are until they're filled with people. I think for a second now, walking forward instead of backward, using my April-May clout to clear a bit of a passage. Hey, April! I hear called from the crowd.
It's a young guy with a sign that reads, "If this is humanity, bring on the invasion." "Hey, handsome," I respond. He'll have a story for his friends, I think. I turn back to the camera and continue walking backward toward Carl. On this truly terrible day, the world mourns. In our mourning, we have to remember that this was not done by an evil world or an evil species. It was done by a few individuals. Yes, the level of sophistication and organization is terrifying. Their goal is to be terrifying, and they have succeeded. I'm scared. Of course I am. But a few fools who killed themselves and others for some unfounded ideal that took hold in their broken hearts, I'm not afraid of them. I'm afraid of their fear. That was one of the lines I had prepped. I look around. People are staring now. They've formed a circle around us and it's getting quiet. These people? I look around as Andy pans the camera. This demonstration? I shout. And everyone shouts. And it's beautiful. And we're all doing it together and it feels so good. People have their cell phones out, recording me as I record them. The scene is covered from every angle. This is what humanity is. Solidarity in the face of fear. Hope in the face of destruction. If the Carls are here for any reason, and amazingly, Carl comes into view right when I say this, towering above the crowd just a few yards away, then maybe they're here not to learn about us, but to teach us about ourselves. I am learning more every day, and I am learning now, that even a chorus of cries distracts me, but it's way too late for me to do anything. Someone has flung themselves out of the crowd just a few feet behind me. You can hear some of the cries distinctly on the video. April, stop him! Watch out! But it is mostly incomprehensible shouts of alarm. He's clearly visible on the tape. He looks like just some white guy. Jeans, blonde hair, medium height, white t-shirt, khaki jacket. He pushes his way out of the crowd and springs right for my back with a 6-inch long knife held up in his fist. I couldn't see any of that, though. I didn't really react in any way until I felt the knife hit me, which is when I screamed. That scream is so loud and awful on the tape that we had to cut it out of the video. Lav mics are really good at picking up only the noise from the person they're clipped to, so it's just straight, raw scream with very little of the background excitement. I only heard it one time during editing and I can call it back to memory at will. If I think about it, I can still feel a little echo of the knife slamming into me just between my shoulder blade and my spine. The knife cut through my brand new suit coat from Topshop the first millisecond and brushed past my shoulder blade the second. It felt like being punched full force by a heavyweight fighter. The ripping of the skin didn't even register over the feeling of the blade hitting my ribs. The pain shot up and down my back from my neck to my tailbone, and then down my arms for good measure. The next moment, the weight of my attacker crashed into me, knocking me forward and down to my hands and knees. Andy was recording at 120 frames per second just in case. That lets you play the video in slow motion if you need to. You would have been able to see every bit of what happened if Andy had held the shot. He didn't, of course. But here's what the camera saw. Half a second after he sees the guy running toward me, Andy's lifting the camera up over his head, thinking not about cinematography but about attack. At first, all you can see is sky and buildings and crowd. But as the camera comes down, lens first, you can see the literal moment that changed history. 1 second, the guy is rushing me and pushing the knife into my back. The next, he goes limp. Not just limp. He loses all structure. All the power he has held tight in his body collapses. In the instant before the camera smashes his face, his skin goes 2 shades darker. His body crashes into mine, knocking me forward. But he's no longer putting pressure on the knife, which wiggles a little in my back. The camera captures itself, slamming into the guy's bizarrely distorted face, and then everything goes black. From the perspective of the cell phone cameras that surrounded us, it's a lot clearer. The guy crashes into me, knife in hand. The next instant, he's a sack of liquid slamming into my back. And the next, Andy crashes the camera down on his face. I didn't ever upload one of those wide shots to my channel, but there are plenty of videos around of it. His face, already bloated and distorted and dark, splits open under Andy's camera like a soap bubble popping. The black mass that squirts and oozes out of the split skin is clearly not blood. I collapse onto my hands and knees, the shape of the body slumping off me onto the ground. In only one video did the camera owner keep his wits together enough to film me rising from my hands to stand. The knife is just sticking there. It turned out to be lodged between two of my ribs. Blood starts seeping through my shirt, but the white suit coat is nice, thick wool, so at this point it doesn't look more than torn. The crowd seems to be made mostly of screams. Some people stand perfectly still, others run. The running and the screaming at the center of the crowd causes panic in every direction. It's a miracle no one died in the stampede. I feel the warm gel sliding down my back as Martin Bellicourt, my own little Gavrilo Princip, lies lumpy on the ground, very, very dead. I turn around to look at the body, and it's barely recognizable as a human. It looks like a bunch of dirty, wet, stained clothes on the street. I look from the body to Andy, and then to Carl, and back to Andy. I'm in shock. Well, not literally, yet. The pain is there, and it is intense, but it's like someone else is feeling it. Andy looks at the camera, covered in the dark gel. He shudders, suddenly pale, and drops it to the asphalt. Are you okay? Yeah, I think I'm fine. And then I add, though it feels like there's a knife in my back. I turn to show Andy, which sends a new wave of pain up my neck and down my back. This is a new, fresher, sharper variety. I flinch, which makes it worse. I feel the knife wiggling around. Moving my left arm in any way is excruciating. Oh my God, April, there's a fucking knife in you, he says. And the wiggling knife, which was only ever an inch deep, falls out of my back, clattering to the ground. It seems as if you are wrong, I say, my head spinning as a fresh, warm stream of blood starts pouring down my back. Oh, Andy, this does not feel good. We both look down at the knife on the ground, a little bloody but almost pathetic for all the damage it ended up doing. It was a little thing. The cheap black plastic handle was designed for the blade to fold into it. There's a picture of it online if you want to see it. It seems even more pathetic in its little evidence baggie. The blade is just a little wider than my finger. Turns out your ribs are really tightly placed in your back. I suppose to protect against this sort of thing. Andy was staring at me, horrified. I guess that's understandable. I wanted the camera. I wanted to finish the video, so I was like, can you grab the camera for me? No, what? April, you've been stabbed. You need to sit down. And then he shouted, we need some help over here. This did not seem like a good plan to me. We came down here for a reason. I've got like half a line left, I said weakly. I was starting to feel dizzy, and suddenly every inch of my skin was covered in sweat. No, April, lie down. You're going to pass out. He was walking toward me with his arms out, ready to catch me. No, Andy, give me the fucking camera. And with that final effort, I was unconscious. I came to about 20 seconds later on the asphalt, in Andy's arms. A news crew had made their way to us faster than the cops or the paramedics. Anyone watching Channel 7 News at that moment, or any other television station anywhere within the next week, was treated to an image of Andy sitting on the ground hugging my unconscious body, calling out for help through his tears, and trying to wake me up. The blood had stained a circle in my coat around my back, and Andy was pushing his hands on it. It's all very dramatic. On replay, they tended not to show me coming to, preferring the simplicity of the bits where I'm completely unconscious and passive. They also didn't show the part where the NYPD arrived and verbally tore the whole TV crew a brand new set of holes. My mouth tastes bitter, and I'm still seeing stars, but I'm conscious by this point. Andy, thank you. I'm sorry. This is a whisper, while two cops start asking him questions. Andy's answering their questions. One cop has a notepad out. He's telling them our names and what happened.
And then he's trying to explain the gunk that's all over us and the stained pile of clothes that used to be Martin Bellicourt, which he's unsurprisingly failing at. Then he just freaks out.
Look, officer, I understand that you're doing your job, but she's just been stabbed, and I don't know what to do. Could we please get some help?
Then I pipe up, nearly shouting,
I concur!
Which causes a fresh wave of stars in my vision. I have no idea why I can't ever shut the fuck up. That's what I should have named this book. I have no idea why I can't ever shut the fuck up. The April May story. Anyway, that actually works, and the cops let the paramedics through. There are 4, possibly 8, possibly 16 of them, and they are all very nice.
Hello, ma'am. I'm Jessica. This is Mitty. We're paramedics, and we're going to have some questions for you. It's very important that you answer truthfully.
Jessica's rattling off questions that she's obviously asked a million times before.
Where does it hurt, ma'am?
Well, mostly the hole in my back where the knife was.
Are you on any drugs?
No.
Are you allergic to any drugs?
No.
Can we cut these very expensive clothes off of you?
Well, I've already bled all over them anyway.
Does this hurt?
A bit.
What about this?
Ah! During all this, Mitty's laying me on my right side on the gurney, taking my blood pressure, shining a light in my eyes, asking me if I can feel and move my fingers and toes, and then pinching my fingers and toes, after which he says, good cap refill in all extremities, and I reply, that sounds like good news. They both laugh. In a matter of moments, I am being loaded into the ambulance.
Hey, can I have a second with my friend?
I ask Jessica.
Yeah, sure. Andy!
I call out. He runs over from where he's been talking to the cops.
Yeah?
Look, this is going to sound shitty, and the first thing is making sure I'm okay. But I think I'm okay, so... And I was honestly embarrassed to say it, which I guess is good. We need to get out in front of this. We need to be the bigger voice, the better voice, or else this will just be another thing they'll blame Carl for. And at that moment, I look over at Carl. Still standing impassive, regal, powerful, oblivious and untouchable. Even missing a hand.
As soon as the cops are done with me, yeah, I'll get on it.
No, the cops are going to take that footage and sit on it. You need to give me the card. He considers this for a moment and then realizes I am probably right.
Dang, girl, you are shockingly lucid for a person with a hole in them.
What about the last line?
Let's just do it now.
He flips on the camera and pops out the mic cable since the EMTs removed my mic with the rest of my clothes. Andy hates using the built-in mic, but he hates accidentally recording something with no audio considerably more. After locating a piece of clean shirt to wipe the lens clean, he squats down, only a foot or so away from my face, better for the built-in mic to pick up good audio.
Rolling.
In the shot, you can see that I'm lying on my side on a gurney. The ambulance is in the background, and you can see Mitty and Jessica milling about. I'm a mess, and there are still streaks of the Bellicourt goop on my face. The only thing I'm wearing on my upper body is a blanket. It's a pretty kick-ass shot. I drop back into my presenting voice, strong and bold, even though it hurts.
As I was saying, even on this most terrible of days, even when the worst of us are all we can think of, I am proud to be a human.
Andy popped out the card and handed it to me under the blanket. I slipped it in my pants pocket. Chapter 17.
We're not supposed to be curious.
This was Jessica, in the ambulance on the 6-minute drive to the hospital, talking loudly over the siren and the rumble of the road. I was on my side, facing Jessica. Apparently they didn't want me lying on the wound.
Explain? I replied.
Well, there are a lot of things paramedics aren't supposed to do. One is wonder what happened. Mostly I don't care. But even when I do, I can't. My job is to keep you as healthy as possible on the way to the hospital. And, well, we're supposed to be extra uninterested if the person in the back is, recognizable.
Oh, well, hello, I'm April May. You may have seen me in such YouTube videos as April May and New York Carl.
Talking hurt, but not that much more than breathing did.
I figured as much.
I liked Jessica.
with her big, thick-framed glasses and bright red lipstick. If I'd had to guess, I'd say she was maybe a couple of years older than me. She was checking my blood pressure and breathing constantly. Am I going to be okay? Interestingly, that's another thing we're not supposed to talk about. If I say you are, and then